Renee, let me ask you about, I mean, the whole issue that kind of came up in the Snowden revelations is, you know, the concern about privacy and whether the government, you know, would be looking at our phone calls, et cetera, and emails, et cetera. But, I mean, in today's world, the reality is that in the age of the internet, there really is no privacy. I mean, you know, everything that a person does on the internet obviously can be sorted out, warehoused by all kinds of global data corporations mm-hmm. that gather that information, sell it to advertisers, sell it to governments, sell it to third-party data brokers. The most intimate details of our lives are available. You know, if you pick up an app of some kind, you can basically track through that app all of what person's doing and be able to gather that information. So I guess my point is, you know, I know we worry about the NSA gathering information, but isn't the reality that the private sector gathers a lot of information more than the NSA, and should we worry about that?
Well, the answer, you know, from my perspective, the answer is yes. In some cases, it is accurate that the private sector are gathering a lot of information. I like to ask audiences when we're having a privacy discussion, how many of them, you know, use certain products, right? So in this audience, I would say, how many of you have Facebook? You want to raise your hand? Go ahead. How many of you have set your privacy settings on Facebook? I'm impressed. That's better than most audiences. We give that away in most of these internet applications when you click through the license. If you're using Google Plus and you're making phone calls using any voice over IP phone calling system, they can track every phone call. And unlike the NSA, who has to do due process, you've given them that right when you click through these licenses. So I think in the privacy discussion, we have to start to raise the awareness of consumers on what they're already doing. You know, we're all living out loud and people are collecting this, but we're actually telling them it's okay, and then they have this data. And we can't have it both ways. So I think that there has to be a lot more of an intelligent dialogue around how do we do appropriate privacy in, you know, in a secure way. And I do believe, and I know this is not a popular belief, you can do both, but you have to give a little bit up. And the fact is, most people are giving it up anyway in the way that they use their social networking today.
Keith, explain what exactly is the information that the NSA gets access to through the Patriot Act? I mean, a lot of people, there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not you're listening to individual conversations. What exactly do you have access to?
So under the Patriot Act, Section 215 authorizes NSA to get the call detail records or business records from the internet service providers. That's the to and from number, the date, time, group, and the duration of the call. Only those four things go into the database. That's all they can have. And so those are put into a database that allows NSA to see who's calling who by number, that can then tell the FBI, for example, when Zazie was in Colorado, we were authorized to look at Zazie's number, and we could go out three hops to see who Zazie was talking to and could tell at the third hop there were terrorists overseas in that pointed to a guy in New York City. All we saw were the numbers, and then we could detect overseas the connection to terrorism. So NSA is not, there is no content, there's no voice, there's no email, it's all telephony to from numbers. That's all the metadata program is, but more importantly, NSA is only authorized to look at it when you have a reasonable articulable suspicion that it's a number associated with Al-Qaeda. You have to document that it's associated with Al-Qaeda. You have to make an auditable record of that, and then that's audited by the court, Congress, and the administration. And the Presidential Review Group found that NSA had done that 100% correct. There were no impact to our civil liberties and privacy other than that which was authorized. And so the issue really comes down to how do we explain that so the American people really understand it. Some politicians will hold up their phones and say they're listening to our phones and they're reading our emails. That's not in that bill at all. That's absolutely wrong.
Let me ask you, because a lot of this relates to the Snowden revelations. Snowden, a contract employee for NSA, releases all of this classified information. I guess a question I would ask is, you know, well, first of all, is he a hero or a traitor? And just exactly what kind of damage has occurred to our security capability as a result of those revelations?
Mike? I think Snowden's a traitor, and I felt that from the beginning. This is an individual who signed an oath, and in that oath agreed to support and defend the Constitution. And not only did he give away highly classified information, in my view, he has cavorted with the enemy to the detriment of the United States and our security. I grew up in a big bureaucracy. I know that it is sometimes difficult to get from the ranks on the floor, if you will, or in the trenches to the top. But there are very specific procedures laid out in law and in policy that if you and regulation that if you have a problem, you can move it to the top. In some cases, you would call it a whistleblower opportunity, et cetera. The point is, he had an opportunity to do that the right way. He did it exactly the wrong way in terms of how he addressed this issue. And so that's how, obviously, I feel very strongly about it. And there are hundreds of thousands of others who've handled this kind of information and done it well. I just think he's a traitor.
If I could just pick up on the damage that's been done. You know, one of the greatest honor and privileges that I had as a senior member of the intelligence community was work with our folks and other agencies around the world to go after terrorists, to bring home hostages, to do all the things that we did. In fact, one of the things when I first met then director of CIA, Leon Panetta, was to actually go through some of the terrorist things that we were jointly doing. These are great things that our folks do for our country, and it will never see the light of day. But they keep us safe, and it was an honor and privilege to do that. Here's what I'm getting from our terrorism analysts now. The amount of information that's being collected is significantly reduced because of Snowden. Terrorists are using levels of encryption and other communications that make it extremely hard, and that puts us and our allies at greater risk. And, you know, so you asked about the Patriot Act and now where we are. And with all that combined, it's the worst of all situations that we could have.
Okay, we're at the halfway mark here. And what I'd like to do is to take this time, as I do, to recognize the question review team, the people that are responsible for selecting the questions that I'll present to the speakers. And if you'll hold your applause, let me introduce them. Krista Almanzon, who's the news director for KAZU Radio, Julie Copeland, who's the city editor for the Santa Cruz Sentinel, Fran Gaver, who's an attorney with Leach & Walker and one of our veteran question review team members, Valentin Mendoza, who is the reporter with the Salinas Californian, and Lisa Mitchell, who's the online editor of the Monterey Herald. If you would thank them, I would appreciate it. And as we do, we have a group of students representing those who attended the afternoon student program. Incidentally, it was a program that was well attended this time of year. We're never quite sure, but we had over 300 students participate in the program. And I'd like to thank all of the students, obviously, that were at the program. And I would like to ask all of the students that are here in attendance to please stand and remain standing until I recognize all of your schools. Thank you very much. The four schools that are represented are the California Maritime Academy, the Defense Language Institute, Foreign Language Center, the Naval Postgraduate School, and the University of California at Santa Cruz. This afternoon, as I said, we had a wonderful turn. You guys can sit down. the student program is made possible because of the generous support of some very, very generous lecture series sponsors. Sylvia and I, along with the Panetta Institute Board of Directors, are very grateful for their sponsorship that allows these students the opportunity from, you know, to come from high schools and colleges and universities and military installations from throughout the Central Coast to come here and listen to our speakers discuss this kind of issue. So I would appreciate it if you would give our sponsors a hand as well. Thank you. All right, let me go to our questions here, and Renee, this is probably directed at you. What is the ideal model for a public-private partnership to improve cybersecurity?
Ideal model, you hang me up on that word. A model, may not be ideal, but will be at least a starting point, would be a framework where we had the legal coverage from a liability perspective to be able to even blind data, notify that something was happening to our companies, that share information about what we're seeing from, you know, attacks and or other activities that are happening in a bi-directional way. Today, if there's something that's known that might be happening to any one of our companies, the government may or may not come and tell us. We're not in a position as public companies, we don't have the right coverage to really give that information or share bi-directionally in near real time what's happening. And that's a very important piece to the beginning of creating a defense capability or even an offensive capability where we use both what's happening to our private companies as well as to the government, which I think is going to be required in any world going forward. It's a fairly big deal to get this done, not only the legislative piece, but also the operating piece. I think we need a piece that says, you know, who do you call, who does what, what's the responsibility, how do we share this data, what does that network look like? So some proposals have been generated around the legislation as well as the operating model, and I'm hoping that we can continue to dialogue and move some of that forward.
Go ahead, Mike.
The only thing I would add to that is what the country badly needs is a national strategy in this area.
I agree with that.
Under which you put those things that Renee's talking about.
That's right.
And that's got to come out of Washington, which is very difficult right now because there isn't much coming out of Washington.
And I'm forging ahead in absence of that.
But no kidding, we need the leadership and a national strategy, which would then sort of give permission to this public-private relationship, which is absolutely vital to solving this problem.
So, it seems to me that the tech community, and this is where Silicon Valley and some of the great tech folks we have on the East Coast combined, can come up with a technical solution that is far superior to anything that we have today. Look at that as a way of ensuring the security of companies, sectors, and industry to government. Set that up and ensure that any legislation helps that technical solution go forward. And I think we have to put that, because if everybody's being hacked, which is the statements that come out today, then our today's solution doesn't work. So I think we need to take a two-pronged approach, put a better technical solution on the table, and ensure future legislation supports going down that road.
The Chinese have developed their own computer operating systems that are closed in contrast to our open systems. How much of a disadvantage is this? While you're answering that question, what are those countries that are abroad that concern us that have the best capabilities when it comes to cyber?
I'll start, and I'll turn it over to Renee and Keith on the technical side. I was in a meeting with Bob Gates, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, when we were actually sort of at the height of a pretty wicked attack. And part of it then was trying to figure out where it was coming from, and it's not instantly known. and we weren't sure. But we know who the cast of characters are, and it's China, it's Russia, actually 4 or 5 years ago, it was not Iran. And one of the things that I'm alarmed about is the improvement in capability in Iran over the last 4 or 5 years. But Bob made a statement, and he's a Russian PhD, and he knows them well from the Soviet days. He made a statement that said we should never forget that the Russians have always been great mathematicians, and they always will be great mathematicians. And if you're in this space and you see them operate, they're exceptionally good. I would argue certainly competing with us, and I consider us to be world class. So they're one. China is another. And I think about this again. What do you do about this? It's a two-way street. They also have vulnerabilities. China is properly and accurately accused of stealing a ridiculous amount of intellectual property, principally so they can keep their economy going. They have not reached a level of innovation and entrepreneurship to create on their own. They're master thieves in that regard so that they can keep their economy going at 6 or 7% to avoid the challenges, the internal challenges, if their economy is growing significantly at a significantly lower rate than that. You've got North Korea, we've seen them lately, and North Korea represents a wonderful asymmetric threat in terms of stirring up our own country, stirring up our own leadership, and not costing a lot of money, time, or effort. And in a way, I see that as they're almost toying with us with this capability. But it's a capability that can do a lot more damage than that. And those are the four, I think, that I certainly would be focused on.
Keith, anything?
Well, I agree. And I would say that Iran and Russia are using this to attack back. When they disagree with our policy, whether it's the sanctions that we have on them for the nuclear programs or sanctions over Ukraine, Crimea, we're seeing attack back. And so Russia and Iran have one approach. And as you mentioned, China is a massive theft of intellectual property to fuel their economy. Both of those are going on simultaneous. I think Russia is by far the best in that group. But China's not far behind in some of their key capabilities. North Korea, and I would just put terrorism on here because I think we're going to see terrorism come up. You may have seen ISIS attacked the French news station and knocked it down for 5 hours. Now, to be honest, this was something that most anybody could have done because the guy, while he's on news, he had behind him his username and password on a post-it note. And so that gave ISIS the leg they needed. So we have now a post-it note that says, don't put your username and password on public TV. But you see, they did keep it down for 5 hours. So they're gaining, and they have no boundary, and there's no way to actually push back on terrorism like you can a nation-state actor.
So you think, I mean, ISIS, of course, we know, is pretty good at using social media. You think that they do have the capability when it comes to cyber attacks?
Well, I think it's growing. I think what we're going to see is that start to play out in the international arena. I think as you push back or we push back in certain areas, they're going to fire out. They are pulling people. Evan Mullins talked about recruitment from Europe, United States, Australia, and some of these people have technical skills. And so the issue is, can you push them down far enough so they can't get access to a viable network? And the answer is not the way they're going. So this is going to come up. And the technology is doubling every 2 years, and they're going to leverage that. Yeah. And so I do think, I think the terrorists can be as good as North Korea very quickly or better.
Renee, is there a cultural disconnect between military IT and civilian IT? And what can be done to close that gap?
That's an interesting question. Cultural disconnect maybe in mindset about preparedness. I don't know. Many of the people who work for me and our security team are ex-military, to be honest. I think some of the best training comes from the military. Again, I would say in any way that we could train more people and leverage some of the military training for civilians would be quite helpful. So maybe the mindset about preparedness is lost when they come into private industry a little bit, or they have a different point of view if they didn't come up through the military. But in general, technologically, they belong to the same communities, and they seem to, you know, have a similar point of view on how to approach things. I just think the preparedness part of it is different. And I think that's the piece where we're going to have to start as private industry to think about preparedness. Because we, you know, if we can get to the point, as he says, and we get a better technical answer and the right framework to do, you know, the collaboration we need to do, we're going to have to be as prepared. So, and you know, we don't think that way today.
There's no substitute for having the offense and the defense trained together.
Yeah, that's right.
In the past, and what industry has is the defense. They have no offense to really train with.
And you don't want
and
us
we
to
haven't
do it.
And by putting yeah, and you probably
you don't want us doing right. offense. Yeah, right.
That's right. But okay. But I think
say
what
that, say that clearly.
Yes,
I don't want
them I do not
that.
Want you want them, to do offense. Yeah.
What you really want to do is make sure the defense is trained to the same level
I agree
as the
with
offense.
That. I agree.
And so what we found in the military is our soldiers who operated, sailors, airmen, Marines, and civilians who operate and defend, were trained at a much lower level than the offensive teams and cleared to a different level. And so at Cyber Command, one of the things that we first took on was build them and train them to the same standards, you know, because they have to be prepared to defend against a world-class adversary. And that hasn't been done, and it's very difficult for industry to understand just what that means, because they're not seeing that adversary like the military and the intelligence community is. Mm-hmm.